When you watch an Olympic relay race, everything just looks incredibly
Oh,
seamless.
yeah, it's totally mesmerizing.
Right. The runners are in perfect sync, the crowd is going wild, and that baton just glides from hand to hand like it's magnetized.
Yeah, it really is the absolute pinnacle of human coordination.
Exactly. But then, you walk into a Fortune 500 company on a Tuesday morning, and suddenly everyone is just dropping the
Talking
baton.
to like today.
Apartments are colliding, emails are flying into the void, and honestly, nobody actually seems to know which direction the finish line even is.
It is the absolute definition of organizational chaos. I mean, we expect these massive corporate machines to run like world-class athletes, right?
Yeah, we really do.
But the reality on the ground is often incredibly messy. The disconnect between the potential of a workforce and the actual execution is just staggering.
And that massive disconnect is exactly what drove a high school track coach named David DeFilippo to essentially infiltrate the boardrooms of massive financial institutions,
Which is quite the career pivot.
to say the least. So today, we're shortcutting your path to understanding how world-class organizations actually develop their people. We're diving into his collection of writings, Reflections of a Corporate Coach.
Yeah, because he went from teaching high school Spanish to being the chief learning officer for organizations like BNY Mellon.
Right, managing like 50,000 employees. Okay, let's unpack this because it's just such a fascinating journey of someone applying a track coach's mindset to the boardroom.
And his perspective is vital here because our goal today isn't just to talk about, dry corporate HR policies.
Right.
Nobody wants that. We're trying to synthesize the hidden mechanics of human potential and skill acquisition in the modern workplace.
So to really understand how to train thousands of corporate employees, we actually have to start on a cinder track in 1988.
A very different kind of training ground.
Exactly. So he's a young high school coach, and at the first practice of the season, before anyone even stretches a single muscle, he does this exercise.
An index card thing, right?
Yes. He hands out a 3x5 index card to all 60 student athletes, and he asks them to write down their specific individual goals for the season.
Just asking them what they personally want to achieve.
Right, like how fast you want to run, how far you want to jump. And then the coaching staff takes those 60 separate cards and synthesizes them to figure out the entire team strategy.
What's fascinating here is that this seemingly simple exercise is actually the bedrock of organizational design.
Wait, really? Just writing goals on a card?
Yeah, I mean, he was taking raw individual ambition and aligning it with a collective outcome. They were smart goals, even if they didn't call them that yet.
Oh, I see.
In the corporate world, goal setting often fails because, well, it gets tied directly to compensation.
Right, your bonus is on the line.
Exactly. So employees end up sandbagging their targets, lowering expectations, just to guarantee they get that money.
Oh, that makes total sense. You play it safe.
But with those teenagers, it was just pure vulnerable aspiration on a piece of paper. And that allowed the coaching staff to build a genuine map of the team's potential.
I love that distinction. And he actually proved the value of that map during a rivalry track meet later on.
Oh, with the relay start.
Yeah, the 4x400 meter relay. It came down to the final event, and DeFilippo knew his runners were objectively slower than the other team.
They just didn't have the raw talent to win on paper.
Right. But every single day at practice, he had forced his team to run the baton handoff drill 10 times a day.
Just the handoff.
Not the sprint, literally just passing the baton. And in the final race, the faster team fumbles, they drop the baton, and DeFilippo's team wins.
Process beating raw talent. It's such a perfect illustration.
It really is.
And it connects back to what DeFilippo learned from his own college coach, who famously told him, "I don't want you to suffer from having permanent potential."
Oh, wow. Permanent potential. That hurts a little bit to hear.
It's a devastating phrase, isn't it? Permanent potential is when you have all the raw materials, the budget, the smart hires, but you lack the deliberate process to actually execute.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, though. If the logic of practicing the handoff is so intuitive, how does that translate to handling a $30 million budget at BNY Mellon?
Wow.
Like, why do huge multi-billion dollar corporations drop the baton constantly? My instinct, if I were suddenly in charge of HR, would probably just be to buy a masterclass subscription for everyone, cross my fingers, and call it a day.
Which is a recipe for total disaster.
I figured as much.
Yeah, it's the exact recipe for the kind of disaster cited in the sources. There's this data from Burson showing a global manufacturing company that had $130 million in completely unrecorded training spend.
Wait, 130 million, unrecorded.
Completely off the books. That money just vanished into the ether because different business units were just, you know, buying up software and hiring random vendors. The fundamentals of coaching just get lost in corporate silos. As companies grow, they decentralize, and they start mistaking mere activity for actual progress.
It's like going grocery shopping without a meal plan. You walk down every aisle, you throw millions of dollars worth of random ingredients into your cart, and you get home and realize you still can't make a cohesive dinner.
That's a great way to put it. And when D'Avlippo arrived at BNY Mellon, he found a very similar overflowing grocery cart.
Lots of random ingredients.
Oh, definitely. They had 34 overlapping management programs.
34.
And 9,000 separate training courses.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so to fix that dinner, he had to consolidate everything into a virtual BK university. And he streamlined those 9,000 courses down to 6,000.
Still a lot, but a massive improvement.
Right. But the real mechanism for that change was his underlying philosophy. He believed human resources needs to stop begging for a seat at the table and actually start setting the table.
Okay, but how does HR actually set the table financially? Because usually, training is seen as the very first thing to get cut when budgets get tight.
Well, you have to start the talent planning process with a formal business review.
Mm.
You treat it exactly like an annual financial budget.
So no more just buying random courses because a manager thinks it sounds fun.
Exactly. You utilize the training investment model, which divides all learning into two strict buckets. There's run the business and change the business.
Okay, break those down for me.
Run the business is your operational baseline. So compliance training or learning new accounting software.
The stuff you just have to do to keep the lights on.
Right. And change the business is your high impact strategic development. Like building a leadership pipeline to open a brand new market in Asia.
Got it.
If the learning team doesn't understand the firm's specific financial drivers first, any training they deploy is just wasted movement.
Okay, so setting the table guarantees we're serving the right meal. But I want to know how we actually cook it. Let's say a company aligns its business goals perfectly. Building the actual training curriculum seems like a massive leap. You can't just throw people in a conference room and hope they learn.
You certainly cannot. And that's where we shift from the philosophy of training to the literal science of it.
It's science.
Yeah, and it has roots in World War II.
Wait, really?
Yeah. So an educational psychologist named Robert Gagné was trying to keep Army Air Corps pilots from, well, falling out of the sky.
Oh, wow. High stakes.
Exactly. Life or death. He couldn't rely on vibes or guesswork. So he built a rigid, methodical framework that we now call instructional systems design, or ISD.
So the way we learn how to use, like, a new CRM software today is based on how World War II pilots learned to fly bombers.
Yep. That framework evolved into the ADDIE model, which stands for Analyze, Design, Develop, Implement, and Evaluate.
Oh, ADDIE.
And the beating heart of that entire ADDIE process is something called the learning objective. D'Filippo explains this using a visual of five concentric circles, kind of like a bullseye.
Let's actually walk through what that looks like in practice, because just listing five circles sounds a bit academic.
Sure, let's do it.
Let's say the outermost ring, the organizational goal, is to launch a brand new AI tool for our clients.
Perfect. So if that is the outer ring, the next ring inward is the role. Who actually needs to execute this?
Let's say it's the enterprise sales team.
Okay, so the third ring in is the competency. What broad capability do they need? They need the ability to explain complex AI architecture to non-technical clients.
Right. And then the fourth ring is skills and knowledge. So that would be like the actual muscle memory of navigating the new software demo.
Exactly. Which brings us to the center bullseye, the learning objective itself.
So it's not just learn AI.
Far from it. The objective is highly specific, like the sales rep will execute a flawless 3-minute software demo without using the word algorithm.
Oh, wow. That is incredibly precise.
And every single piece of training material you build must serve that specific, highly targeted bullseye.
Okay, so what does this all mean for a modern tech company? I have to push back here. Isn't a rigid 1940s model like ADDIE way too slow for today's digital agile world?
That is a very valid pushback. The industry actively wrestles with that exact tension.
Because tech companies pivot in weeks, not years. If you spend 6 months analyzing and designing, The software is already obsolete by the time you implement it.
Right. And that's why newer frameworks have emerged, like SAM, the Successive Approximation Model.
SAM.
Yeah. It allows for rapid prototyping and agile iterative design. You build a little piece of the training, test it with users, adjust it immediately.
Okay, that sounds way more modern.
It is. But DeFilippo strongly defends the core architectural blueprint of ISD. He argues that regardless of how agile your design process is, if your central learning objective doesn't clearly map all the way back through those concentric circles to the outermost organizational goal, the training simply shouldn't exist.
So agility without alignment is just getting to the wrong destination faster.
Spot on.
Getting to the wrong destination faster is honestly a great way to sum up a lot of corporate initiatives.
Unfortunately true.
Okay, so TwainEI ensures your employees know exactly which buttons to push on the new software. That covers the technical science of learning.
Right.
But knowing how to do a task doesn't mean someone is equipped to lead the team doing the task. I mean, you can't ADDIE your way into emotional intelligence.
No, you really can't. That requires a completely different mechanism.
Right. It requires transitioning to the art of human growth, which brings us to a massive point of confusion in the corporate world. The difference between coaching and mentoring.
People use the words interchangeably all the time, but their mechanics and their historical origins are wildly different.
Let's start with mentoring, because the history here is fascinating. It actually has its roots in Greek mythology.
Right, with Odysseus.
Exactly. When Odysseus left for the Trojan War, he entrusted the education of his son to his loyal friend, whose name was literally Mentor.
Which is a tremendous amount of pressure on that friend, to say the least. But because of that origin, mentoring is historically advice-based. It's an experienced elder passing down wisdom.
It's very informal, right?
Yes, it relies heavily on a natural sense of kinship between the two people. It's designed for long-term career mapping. Mentees must have a voice in choosing their mentor, because if that organic chemistry isn't there, the relationship feels forced.
Yeah, totally hollow.
And DeFilippo notes that you can actually supercharge a mentorship by introducing a BHAG.
A big, hairy, audacious goal.
Exactly. So, for example, he required mentees to spend a year preparing to present a solution to a real business problem in front of a panel of senior executives.
That is terrifying.
It is. But that high-stakes goal acts as a catalyst. It instantly moves the mentorship from casual, aimless chats over coffee to highly purposeful and urgent conversations.
Okay, so then on the entirely opposite end of the spectrum, you have coaching.
Right.
The word coach actually comes from the 1500s, and it originally referred to a carriage, a literal vehicle designed to take someone from where they are to where they want to go.
And if you lean into that carriage metaphor, the distinction becomes crystal clear. A carriage driver doesn't decide the destination, right?
No, the passenger does.
Exactly. The passenger tells the driver where they want to go, and the carriage just provides the wheels and the momentum to get them there.
That makes so much sense.
That perfectly illustrates the Socratic method of coaching. A true coach doesn't tell you what to do. They use inquiry, they ask probing, sometimes uncomfortable questions to prompt self-discovery.
So it's much more structured than mentoring.
Yes, it's short-term, it's bound by a specific contract, and it's aimed at navigating a very specific career transition.
So think about your own life right now as you're listening to this. Are you currently looking for a vehicle to help you cross a very specific, difficult bridge in your career?
If so, you need a coach.
Right. Or are you looking for a lifelong guide to teach you how to navigate the broader wilderness of your industry over the next decade? That means you need to find a mentor.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, world-class organizations don't choose between the two. They deploy both in tandem.
Oh, at the same time.
Yeah, for high-potential employees. You might have an executive coach pushing you to improve your public speaking over a 6-month contract, while simultaneously having a mentor who helps you navigate internal politics over 6 years. The critical factor is transparency about the different timelines and boundaries.
Wow. Okay. We have built quite the theoretical architecture so far. We set the table financially. We mapped out the World War II science of training. We explored the carriage metaphor.
We covered a lot.
But human beings are inherently messy. How does all of this pristine theory survive contact with the actual messy reality of managing people?
Honestly, it rarely survives intact without leaders who have actually been in the trenches.
Which DeFilippo talks about, right?
Yes, he advocates strongly for the necessity of being a first-line manager early in your career. You simply cannot design systems for people unless you have supervised the employees who interact directly with clients.
You have to feel the friction of the user experience yourself.
Exactly.
There is this visceral story in the sources about a dreaded performance review document that highlights this perfectly. If you've ever sat in a windowless H office waiting for your annual review, your heart rate is probably spiking right now.
Oh, the orange paper story.
Yes. Early in DeFilippo's career, the official company review form was printed on this aggressive, bright orange paper.
The employees were so intimidated by it, they colloquially referred to it as Agent Orange.
Which tells you literally everything you need to know about the company culture at the time. The sheer sight of this orange paper spiked their anxiety before a single word of feedback was given.
So what did you do?
He found a brilliant workaround. He typed out the actual feedback on a plain, calming, white sheet of paper, placed it over the orange form, and stapled it.
He literally hid the orange.
Yes. Just to make the emotional process less terrifying for his team, a company can have the best developmental intentions in the world, but if the interface, the orange paper, is terrifying, the entire feedback loop fails.
That is such a great example. It proves that the delivery mechanism matters just as much as the content.
Absolutely.
But the messy reality of leadership is also about how you handle completely unexpected moments. DeFilippo tells this highly relatable story about his early days working at UPS.
Oh man, the truck story.
Yeah. He was driving his delivery truck down the highway and the engine literally blew up.
Just blew up.
Spewing smoke, caught on fire, completely destroyed.
So
he's sitting on the guardrail, covered in soot, having an objectively terrible day.
Understandably.
And this well-dressed woman pulls over, walks up to the burning truck, and asks if he's okay. Because he's exhausted and frustrated, he fires back with a really sarcastic comment.
Which, honestly, is a completely human reaction in that moment.
Totally human.
Chaos.
Until she introduces herself as the regional business development manager.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And as the story goes, a few months later, he gets promoted into sales. And this exact woman is his brand new boss.
You're kidding.
Her first words to him in his new role were, "Well, I hope you take better care of your car than you did your delivery vehicle."
That is brutal. But it's such a stark reminder that your leadership shadow is always being cast, even when your truck is literally on fire on the side of the highway. First impressions do not care about your bad day.
No, they don't. And this raises an important question about the most critical psychological concept in DeFilippo's reflections.
Which is?
Well, when the reality of leadership doesn't just involve a sarcastic comment on the highway, but a fundamental breach of trust, the entire organizational structure collapses. Two organizational psychologists, Chris Argyris and Donald Shane, coined this framework of espoused theory versus theory in use.
Okay, what's the difference?
Espoused theory is what we publicly claim to believe. Our mission statements, the noble values painted on the lobby wall. Theory in use is how we actually behave when the pressure on and no one is looking.
The sources outline a tragic, massive example of this disconnect. The Adelphia Cable bankruptcy.
Yeah. DeFilippo was doing consulting work near their headquarters in Coudersport, Pennsylvania, in the early 2000s. He walked into their corporate building and saw these grand, inspiring corporate values painted everywhere.
Words about integrity, community, trust.
Exactly. That was their espoused theory.
But the founding Regas family's actual theory in use was, well, treating a publicly traded company like a personal piggy bank.
Hiding billions of dollars in off-balance sheet debt.
Using corporate funds to build a private golf course.
Buying a professional hockey team. All while projecting this image of folksy small-town integrity.
It's wild. And when the fraud was exposed, the company went bankrupt and was completely dismantled. But it didn't just hurt the shareholders. It devastated the local economy of that small Pennsylvania town.
Thousands of people lost their jobs because the leadership's daily actions actively mocked the values they forced their employees to memorize. It doesn't matter how mathematically perfect your ADDIE training models are, or if you have the most robust mentoring programs in the world. If the tone at the top contradicts the espoused theory on the wall, the entire culture rots from the inside out.
So alignment isn't just about matching a training course to a business goal.
No, it's about matching your daily unseen actions to your stated values.
Let's bring all of these threads together because we've covered a massive amount of ground today.
We really have.
We started by treating corporate skills like a high school track relay, proving that process and practicing the handoff will consistently beat raw talent.
Yeah.
We learned that HR needs to stop asking for permission and start setting the table by tying every initiative directly to the firm's financial drivers.
running the business versus changing the business.
Exactly. Then we broke down the life or death World War II science of the EDDI model, contrasting it with the Socratic passenger-driven art of coaching. And finally, we saw how crucial it is that your messy everyday actions actually match the espoused values painted on your wall.
DeFilippo has essentially provided a comprehensive architecture for unlocking human potential here, moving all the way from the mechanical to the deeply psychological.
So as we wrap up, I want to challenge you, the listener, to evaluate your own career right now.
Yeah, look inward.
Are you, or is the team you manage, suffering from permanent potential? Do you have the raw talent but lack the deliberate practice?
Maybe you need to seek out a mentor and ask them for a terrifying BHE to jumpstart your trajectory.
Or maybe you just need to take a hard look in the mirror and check if your own espoused theory aligns with your daily theory in use.
And as you reflect on those questions, I want to leave you with one final thought to ponder. We've seen today that our most effective modern corporate learning models are built on historical foundations, right?
Instructional design from World War II, coaching from ancient Greece.
Exactly. But what will be the foundational model for human learning in the rapidly approaching AI-driven future?
Oh, that's a big question.
As technology scales and algorithms can generate instantaneous, perfectly aligned ADD training modules, will AI become our new Socratic coaches? Will they prompt our self-discovery with mathematically perfect questions?
Or is human kinship that unquantifiable spark between a mentor and a mentee, the empathy of a manager putting a white piece of paper over an orange one, the one variable in the formula of human potential that can never be automated? It really makes you wonder. When the corporate machine gets even more complex and the pace of business gets even faster, will an AI know how to teach us to hand off the baton? Or will we just keep dropping it? Thanks for taking the deep dive with us.